It is Saturday, December 20th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hi, Ben.
Hey, I love that theme.
I know, it's fun, isn't it? It's by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. He gave us that theme a while ago. In fact, now that the theme at the front of the show and at the end of the show is completely open source, Creative Commons.
Yeah.
Our show is completely Creative Commons, and it's share attribution, which means that you can do anything you want with our content as long as in your content you've created, you've mentioned us. So that's all you got to do, and you can do anything you want with it. You can make money on it, anything. Doesn't matter to us. There.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So how can we make money on GeekSpeak?
15 years and I can't figure it out. 14 years, excuse me, and I can't figure it out. But also in the air with me is a software engineer and political junkie, Mr. Miles Elam. Hi, Miles.
Good morning.
It's so good to see you guys. Let's start by talking about how nature can teach us about weather.
I love this story. This story is, so some scientists were tracking a group of birds, specifically golden-winged warblers in the Appalachian Mountains, and the birds finished their seasonal migration, and they had little GPS kinds of things on them. And a couple days after they arrived, they left again. And they flew south. And a couple days later, a tornado went straight through the area. And they flew around the bottom of the tornado and then went straight back home.
Okay, so the birds actually moved prior to people going, hey, a tornado.
Yeah, the birds moved 2 days before the tornado swept through. And they're just like, you know.
Is this coincidence?
Something's up, you know. So I was thinking about, okay, so what are the typical reactions to this story? Like, one is, oh my gosh, birds are awesome and they know something that we don't know, right? And another is, oh, there's something supernatural going on. So I'd like to just toss out the second one and talk about the first one. I've been doing a lot of thinking about...
What about the third one, which was mine, which was coincident?
Coincidence, yeah. There could be coincidence.
Okay, but
yeah.
Let's talk about the production part.
Like, there are no coincidences.
I've been thinking a lot about machine learning algorithms where you just throw a bunch of data at a computer program that is adaptive, and then the computer manages to find patterns that humans can't can't understand. Like, we couldn't get this information, you know?
Warning, oversimplification. Go on.
God, a bit of it. Not too oversimplified,
and
but...
it's a machine learning algorithm that you're applying to a data set.
Right.
Extremely pedantic.
And the idea there is that the data set, the algorithm processes something, does something, and then modifies itself to improve its outcome over time. So that...
With some of them. So, for example, if you look at neural nets, for example, there's a bit of an evolution-y feel to it, right?
Right.
The machine is testing and then changing and then testing again and then changing and testing again. And
but
that's,
you have to define what an optimal result would be, though. That's one of the limitations of that. Mm-hmm. It's not, yeah.
But this also happens with animals over time. This is what happened with us as we evolved from primates, and this is also what happened as birds evolved. So, you know, they're groups of birds that were wiped away by
tornadoes.
Tornadoes or hurricanes or weather events. And eventually the ones who were able to pick up on subtle cues, subtle atmospheric conditions or something that maybe indicate danger, and then they left, those are the ones that survived.
But that's why birds are horrible dinner guests, because they just leave the room whenever the barometric pressure changes.
Yeah, they leave like 3 minutes before the political argument starts. They figure it out.
Well, there's a question. Is it barometric pressure that they're catching, or is it ionization in the atmosphere, because they do navigate through magnetics?
Yeah, so this is one of the interesting questions, is in these situations where, you know, dogs freak out 2 minutes before an earthquake or, you know, something like that, what is it that they're reacting to? And we don't necessarily know, because we're coming at it from a top-down approach as opposed to
a complex system approach.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I believe with dogs, it's actually the low-frequency rumbling that happens ahead of time.
Yeah, can dogs hear that low frequency?
It's also it's vibrational at that level. But yes, their hearing is substantially better. So even if it's just at the edge of human hearing, if it just goes just slightly below, yeah, they'll be able to pick it up.
Wow. Yeah, because we can hear all the way down to 20 hertz.
Birds. Tornadoes.
Anyway, the thing I love about this is just that, I guess, as humans, we like to think that we know things, right? Mm-hmm. And we like to think that we can figure things out, and we definitely do know things, and we can figure things out. But there are some things that are just too complicated for our brains. Like, to bring it back to evolution, our brains are not evolutionarily predisposed to deal with large data sets. That's why we have computers doing things, you know? And also over long periods of time like that. So I don't know. I think it's a kind of a cool story. Also, I would like to...
Is there more to the story if we want to read more about it?
I'll put a link on geekspeak.org. I would also like to refute the factoid that dogs can hear lower than us, which is not true. Dogs can hear from 40 hertz, and we can hear from 20. They can hear as high as 60 kilohertz, though. So, anyway, who knows? I don't actually know.
Throwing down the gauntlet.
Boom. Okay. Miles, pedanticism.
One thing, though, that we would like to mention, though, is when someone, as Ben had mentioned, says, like, oh, they have some type of telepathy or forethought or something that is metaphysical. That's... For me, anyway, one of the great things about science is it doesn't say, this is how birds do it, and just throw out an answer. Because when you say telepathy, you're throwing out an answer. Right. It goes, hey, I have no idea how that happened.
Let's investigate. Find out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Science rocks.
All right. Let's do some legal stuff now, Miles.
Speaking of science, law.
So a couple of rulings that have come down. A federal judge in New Jersey has stated that it's okay for police officers to create fake Instagram accounts or fake social media accounts to befriend people, and because they are more likely to share information that maybe they shouldn't be. Like, for example, if someone has stolen an item, in this example, a diamond bracelet.
Okay.
And then they take a photo of it and put it up on Instagram and go, hey, check it out, guys. Then if they have a close relationship with the fake account, then the cops can see the picture and they go, hey, wait a second. That looks like the one that was reported stolen by the jewelry store on, you know, 85th.
And so there was a question of whether it was legal for a cop to create a fake account?
Yes. Whether or not you can do so, whether they could do so and then use any evidence they gathered by that process against you in court. And a federal judge in New Jersey has said, yes, they can use that as evidence.
Okay. So what other crazy things can cops do? I mean, I think that makes sense that a police officer can go ahead and make a fake identity. I'm curious what the Instagram policy is, though.
Right. If they take a fake identity, is very much like going undercover, I guess, in this case.
Yeah.
So taking on a different identity.
Does Instagram's policies allow for identities that don't match
that
people?
I don't know.
I mean, I do know that Instagram... I don't think it has a very strict policy on who you are, because I know the names can be anything. It's not like some accounts where the service wants you to use a real identity. All right.
The other one is some police in Washington State have put up a webcam on a utility pole to spy on a house that was suspected of drug dealing. Just put it up there for 6 weeks where they could pan and zoom.
Okay.
And the police perspective was, this is like if we just set a cop out there and we were at a right of way, a public right of way, and just looking at it, doing a stakeout. And a federal judge on Monday tossed out that evidence, because they were saying that if you are doing this without you have this surveillance set up and it's without a warrant, that violates Fourth Amendment.
Well, see, the general concept that you if you feel like you have a privacy your expectation of privacy is the general concept, right? Mm-hmm. That's a private environment. And so years ago, when planes could fly over, you know, if you had a yard that had a large fence, you could assume that that was private. But since air flight is so common, you can't really assume it's private, right? Because mm-hmm. a plane would fly over. Therefore, police could theoretically have a hovering thing above your house, looking at, around your house. Right. So I kind of get the telephone pole concept that, you know, it is outside your environment, but the way that our tech works is that it gets the borderline of what is feasible with technology
right.
always changes.
In the past,
and so
yeah.
people that are undereducated about what kind of technology, you don't know that actually drapes don't block infrared, therefore it's pretty easy to see into a house even with the drapes closed, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't know that that's possible, then how would the person should feel like they're private when the drapes are closed.
Right. There actually was a precedent where some law enforcement was using thermal cameras outside of a house and saying, hey, we're outside the house. We're not actually going inside the house. But it was basically giving them an X-ray view of where people were, what they were doing. And so it does come into that question of that area needs to be private. Your private residence needs to be private. Except in the case where there is a actual interest, like you believe there's criminal activity going on, in which case you go to a judge and you say, hey, I think that there's criminal activity going on there. Can you sign this warrant giving me the right to go past that
privacy thing? Yeah,
that's
sure.
what warrants are for,
right.
is to say there is probable cause of...
So this webcam on the telephone pole, or excuse me, utility pole, was not endorsed by a judge first. The police were able to do it in their own... Yeah, I don't know. It feels a little inappropriate to me. At the same time,
if they had gotten a warrant and it was specific, and the thing is, warrants are supposed to be very specific about what they're looking for. So it's like you have a warrant to do that. You're looking at the specific area. That makes sense. But if you're just going, hey, we think there might be something going on, let's put up webcams at random spots and see what we get.
Yeah,
you know, or even all the places that we suspect. But even though, but it hasn't gone through a vetting process of any kind.
Yeah. Well, so that kind of reminds me of a story. The EFF has been suing the
Electronic Frontier
Foundation has been suing the federal government with regards to the domestic tapping or the tapping of the domestic internet backbone and collecting everything and claiming that just like that webcam, you really need to have a warrant first to look broadly at things, right? To investigate. That's the whole point of warrant. And it's interesting. They've got a great diagram talking about the backbone and what traffic's in there, and then their process of tapping it, and then the process of filtering it down to be only domestic. And then after they filter it, or only not domestic, I should say, then after that point, you can assume, and then doing a search on particular potential criminals that they actually have names for. After that point, the data then looks potentially like legal data to look at. But the problem is that first sweep is not legal, is the argument of the EFF. And this discussion is about they're looking at whether the case can move forward. So it's a preliminary discussion with the judge. Took, some crazy amount of time for the judge to understand the thing. It was six, the judge basically went over it for 4 hours, just the questions back and forth. It's like 12 questions. On trying to understand the scope of the problem, right? So I can just imagine this room trying to educate this judge on what a tapping and backbone really is, because you have to get a little technical to understand the scope of it.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah. Though the diagram that I'll put up at geekspeak.org is relatively simple to understand, I'll show you guys real quick. The actual details of how that works and what it means, you have to understand to be able to make a judgment on whether the diagram makes sense, right? Like, it's not... So I'm assuming the judge is learning a lot about internet technology.
It's funny. Something that comes to mind for me is that, doing a quick plug, that HBO's The Wire should be required viewing.
because they talk about these things?
Yeah, because you're talking... That's what the term... That's where the name The Wire comes from, is you're doing wiretaps. And they aren't on internet, for example, but they are on the phones, and they do cover like what are the rules allow for, and also the incentives for skirting the rules, and the consequences thereof, and things like that. So it's just one of those very complex topics that requires some background and some thought. There is no simple answer.
How technically accurate is that show? I haven't seen it.
Technically accurate? It doesn't
like
really
in terms
go
of
in
laws and stuff.
Reasonably so. I mean, it glosses over them. It's not all okay. that.
There's no magic going on. It's supposed to represent reality. You know, the thing is, everybody's using it. It's kind of dated at this point because everybody uses pagers.
They use cell phones. They use burner cell phones.
Oh, I thought they used pagers. So, so this court case was originally submitted.
Word of warning, though. The Wire is very violent.
Yeah,
so
yeah, that's true.
Discretion is advised.
Probably why I'm not watching it.
The original case, it was 2008. Carolyn Jewell submitted against the National Security Agency. So it's Jewell versus the National Security Agency is the case. And this is about a summary judgment for a partial summary judgment that was filed in July 2014. And the judge, this is all in Oakland, a federal judge in Oakland, California, Jeffrey White, the district judge. So if you're interested in the case, there's more information about it, and we'll post the stuff up at geekspeak.org. You are listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. Why are some people more afraid of vacations than the diseases they're designed, or vaccinations than the diseases they're designed to prevent? Pat Nora Biss began to wonder when she had her first child and faced the vaccination question herself. She also began to write, and her new book, On Immunity, has been named one of the year's 10 best by the New York Times. She talks to KOSP's Robert Pauly about the history of vaccination and the anti-vax movement, our distrust of modern medicine, the nature of immunity, and illnesses as metaphor. That's tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project here on KOSP. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. Miles, what have you seen on the internet lately?
I saw a lava flow going through a snowfield.
Hey, I saw that too this morning. Well, you showed it to me.
Cool.
It's kind of cool.
I'm assuming it melts the snow. So, lava winds?
Not the way you'd think.
That's true.
It's not like it melts all the snow in the area all at once coming through. You actually have a borderline where the molten rock, or the rock at that point that is cooling, is pushing along the line of the snow, and there isn't as much steam as you would expect all at once.
Oh, cool. Cool. Okay, so you can find that out at geekspeak.org. Miles, will you go ahead and post that now so people can do it?
Yes, it's based in Kamchatka, Russia, or the Kamchatka Krai, or Kamchatka Peninsula. It's eastern Russia that is along the Pacific Ocean. And it's really interesting watching it go through there. It's the same type of lava as you would find on the Big Hawaiian Island. So slow moving, the top crust ends up being relatively cool as it insulates, and that insulation makes it so that it doesn't immediately melt all the snow until it catches a pocket of it and then spews out some steam. Anyway, you'll see the video on the website.
It's worth watching.
Yeah, I've made the show page live, so if you want to add that bit while Ben talks about...
Ben.
Oh,
I've got another... Yeah, I've got another thing worth watching.
Oh, okay. So.
This is exactly great. The Orion test space vehicle. This is the test space vehicle. Eventually, the Orion program will be sending astronauts into deep space and then returning them, presumably. So they did their first space-worthy flight, and they attached a camera to the back of this vehicle as it was re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. And this is the first time I've ever seen this. I don't know if this has been done before. I'm sure it must have been. But it is a beautiful video. It's 10 minutes, and you can watch the craft re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, and you can also see it kind of... you can see the parachutes deploying and everything. It's just absolutely an awesome, awesome video. And definitely worth watching. So that will also be up at geekspeak.org.
Cool. All right. So, Miles, you want to tell us about some virtual reality stuff?
If you've ever wondered what it's like to live in the shoes of someone who has a different skin color than you are,
okay,
then you're not alone. Some researchers have put up a virtual reality environment, some psychologists, experimental psychologists, and what they're looking to do is you put on your goggles, you have you interact with others in this virtual environment, only your avatar doesn't look like you. They look like someone who is a different skin tone.
So the people you're interacting with see you as having a different skin tone as you do within this virtual environment.
Right. And many studies have shown that people react differently to people, especially if those communities are very homogenous and someone comes into the community that is of a darker skin tone, for example, in the case of the U.S. But at the same time, there isn't always the case of a racial epithet being spoken, or
it's more subtle.
Right.
And especially when you're being watched.
It may not even be conscious by the person who is perpetrating the act. And one of the ways that you can make it more visible is for someone to experience it themselves and see that difference. And that's an area where I think this experiment, and hopefully many others to come in the future.
Where is this experiment happening? So the virtual reality concept, of course, it's like a game in the sense that it's computer generated, and then you put in goggles that immerse your vision. So your vision is the game itself, and then you actually stand up, most likely, I'm assuming. I mean, it depends on how the game is played, so that it feels like you're in the room with other people that are also, and of course, those other people in potentially different locations, and maybe they're even computer generated. But the idea being that I would assume that the room would be full of a homogenous environment, and then you would represent an outsider in that environment, so you'd come into it, right?
Or just even if you aren't, even if you vary it up a bit, that you are, your appearance is different than.
But, well, I mean, our virtual. The question I have, I guess, about this is the virtual reality concept of it. Does that kind of stuff translate? I mean, you could also be a 15-foot dragon, and yeah, you'd treat them differently. I mean, like, you would seem. I would think that the virtual environment, a different person might not represent the same type of difference as in a physical environment.
So, first off, did you just compare someone with a darker skin to that of a dragon?
No. No, what I'm saying is that in a virtual environment, your perspective of what is alien, what's not alien, is such that a 15-foot dragon might be a friend, right? So your idea of what is alien is crazy.
Well, it's about preconceived notions, not about what's really crazy.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is that in a virtual reality, my preconceived notion might be that, yeah, it's cool for everybody to fly. Right? Like in the real world, my preconceived notions are pretty standard on, you know, the reality. But in the virtual reality, I let go a lot of things and things are not as.
Yes.
Right?
There's quite a lot of work being done in social cognition, behavioral psychology, with regard to even showing photos of people of different ethnicities and then going through and saying, here are a bunch of words, which ones seem most appropriate. There definitely shows bias there.
You do bias detection subtly, but also the experience of being biased against subtlety, you pick up on it.
Right. And then there's stuff like, you know, on Twitter, a bunch of people going hog wild about, hey, there's a new Star Wars trailer up there, and, you know, you can talk about different things. But then you have a bunch of people saying, wait, a black stormtrooper?
Right.
So, I mean, it's, yeah.
Okay, cool. So where's the study?
This one, it was published in a journal called Trends in Cognitive Science. It was a European team of researchers, many different institutions.
But a nicely published paper, so they've got some summaries and some conclusions, I'm assuming, that came out of it.
Yes, and you can read more about it on the website.
And conclusions would be? Can you pick up on the traits when your skin tone is different? Does this subject actually learn a little bit more about what it's like?
Well, the thing is, virtual reality as we have it right now, where it's at the where it's not just simple polygons like in the 80s, you know, things like that, hasn't been around for very long. So it's going to take some time to really gather the data. Right now, they're just talking about their methodology.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles. Let's talk about some security breaches because we haven't talked about it in a while. Ben, can you catch us up to speed?
Yes, I've got an update about the Staples security breach.
The Staples one? I heard about that one.
That was back in October.
Okay.
But the news is that, yes, customer payment cards information may have been released. Of course, they're saying may have been. That probably means
it was.
Yeah. Rather than.
So Staples was hit by the same type of thing that we saw hit
Target and Home Depot.
Home Depot. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It was a point of sale.
Right.
Point of sale system at 115 Staples locations. So this is not everywhere. And it was most of them were between August 10th and September 16th. of this year, and two of the other stores, the malware was actually active a little bit longer than that. But yeah, it's really, this is going to be the new, I guess, normal, right?
Yeah, millions of cards being being released as the new normal.
It sadly kind of is. I mean, security is really, really hard, and breaking security is becoming, I would argue, is becoming easier as it becomes easier as the complexity of systems increases. So the more complicated a system, the more little nooks and crannies you could write a worm to, you know, worm its way into your system and escalate its permissions and get information and data.
All right, let's go from that right into an update on Sony. We have some ideas of where the Sony hack came from now.
Yes, we do. That was North Korea, actually. So the FBI has announced that it's linked to North Korea. They said they were, quote, centrally involved in the hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment. So,
do you believe that? Miles, what do you think?
I think it's amazing what you can do with a Gateway brand 486 with 2 megs of RAM.
Wait, what do you mean?
North Korea is fairly isolated with regard to technology.
Yeah.
And admittedly, they could get some stuff funneled through through China. But with regard to the state-sponsored stuff, like, yeah, I guess they could be involved. I am wary of using that as anything actionable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aside from things like Gulf of Tonkin, the precursor to the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Things like that where you blame a particular subject and that becomes a justification for further action. I don't know.
The thing that gets
the U.S.
me is
has been involved with Stuxnet, and that finally it hit us seems disingenuous to go like, oh, it was North Korea. Yes. Okay. Now what?
I don't know. I mean, when you say it hits us, yeah, Sony, I mean, it's an international corporation.
Right.
So
right.
It's not really I wouldn't say it's a domestic only thing. It's, you know, it happens to be that most of Sony Entertainment is in the U.S., but it's not like it's a, first off, it's not a real thing. It's a corporate entity.
Mean,
it's,
let me also preface it with saying that suffix it in this case.
Yes.
With a crime was committed. I'm not sanctioning that the crime was committed. And while there are measures that companies can take, the individual rank and file, you know, you're kind of caught in the crossfire. Like all the people who were just rank and file who had their emails stolen, their private lives,
or if you have your social security taken. I mean, there's so much information that was lost. So many victims here.
Yeah, I have a very large amount of sympathy for you. At the same time, I should say, if you're on a corporate email account, don't talk about these personal matters and don't put your social security number up on an email system.
I agree.
Which is,
do you have any other solutions?
Just to be clear, that's difficult to do, especially for people who are not as technically in the know, right? Mm-hmm. So actually, Bruce Schneier put an opinion piece talking about the Sony attack up, and I just want to read this one quote from it. The rest I'll leave you to go to the site yourself and read it. But he wrote, quote, "Your reaction to the massive hacking of such a prominent company will depend on whether you're fluent in information technology security. If you're not fluent, you're probably wondering how in the world this could possibly happen. If you are, you're aware that this could happen to any company."
Okay. I agree with the synopsis, I basically said last week. Though I've got to say that if you're not familiar with internet technology at the level that like we are, the geeks, it's not about – I don't think how could this possibly happen. I think people go, well, computers. Like, it's very dismissive. It's very easy to go, yep, I didn't trust them anyway. I mean, that's the sentiment I would think people are feeling at this point, right? I know that they get – you know, general people get, you know, hounded by the idea of got to be secure, got to change your password, all these different rules. But the truth is it's just a wash of something they don't understand being complex. And sometimes they're told by people like us, some experts, that it's totally safe and trustworthy. Well, and sometimes we say, oh, it's totally easy to be cracked.
Well,
and
no, I think I disagree. I think anyone who interacts with computers in any kind of corporate environment would think, how could this possibly happen? Especially if they did change their password like their security people told them to, and if they did take whatever steps they could to avoid this, you know, like if you're in the know about security, then only then, I think, can you be can you actually behave properly and keep all of your medical information off of your corporate email, your social security number, all of that stuff. But it's really easy. I mean, speaking from personal experience, it's really easy to send an email to the wrong email address or from the wrong email address. And so, one little mistake like that, if your company is later hacked, could be a problem.
So let me ask you, what do you think about... is your corporate? Do you find it surprising that corporate, you know, companies' networks can be hacked? Let us know at geeks@geekspeak.org. I'd fascinated to find out what your opinion is on this kind of thing. Is it shocking or is it expected? Is it magic or is it you know, people not doing their job? Like, where's the feeling of blame come from? What's the perspective on that corporate environment? And Miles, I'll let you address also not that question specifically, but more of the idea of what to do and what not to do in a corporate environment.
Well, this is what I'm wondering about with regard to, and I'll ask the rest of you here. When is it ever acceptable to type in your social security number into an email?
Never.
Like,
but the social security numbers weren't in emails, right? That's the thing about your.
They
saying,
were in systems.
The company that I work for has my social security number. They have to, right? Because they have to hire me. Like, that's law.
Well, all of our medical system.
They have to pay me and they have to reserve taxes on me, so they do that. I mean, it's part of employment to share the social security. In fact, that's only the time you probably should is when money's being exchanged, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not an email, right? You shouldn't be doing that in email. Most corporations have some kind of interface, or you actually write it down and then it goes into another, you know, somebody takes the written down and puts it in a folder. I mean, that's the kind of thing we normally see. But besides that, yes, you're right. Never email social security number.
That's like you never put your password in there. And that seems to go along with a lot of things. Like, don't put your medical information into a corporate email account. Don't put...
But I think it's... I don't know. I do think the how could this possibly happen sentiment makes a lot of sense, because it wasn't just email, you know, it was all of the systems. Like, they got pretty much everything, you know. We were talking about that after the show.
Well, right. I think that it's true that what has happened to Sony, it's going to happen to other companies, right? This was a large, I mean, it obviously.
In fairness, Sony... I think it is fair to say Sony has a systemic problem with security, considering their Sony online problems that have been recurrent.
I agree.
That there may be a culture issue there.
Yeah, and there is a way of doing a network that Sony probably does, that where you have one authentication, you have lots of computers, they're connected together, and people are using file sharing. Like, that kind of environment, it's a more traditional technical corporation environment, is not the environment that companies are moving towards, right? Mm-hmm. We're moving towards portals of applications that manage the sharing, right? So, for example, in a lot of corporations, you have a service like Google Docs, where you can upload a file, it gets scanned, it gets looked at before anybody else can see it. You know, so you're referencing through technology that's a little more complex and a little safer than in an environment where it's a whole bunch of file shares. I remember when we worked at Feed the Monster, Miles, Code Red or something? What was that name of that virus that came through?
I think it was Code Red. It was a macro virus, a Word virus.
Yeah, and so the Word virus, all it had capability of doing is accessing files and deleting them, which it did. And so since everybody was connected to the same SharePoint, the same file share, one user got infected, all the files got infected, and all the files that weren't of the right type got erased, and then anybody else that opened the file that was infected got infected. Like, it was a very simple way of propagation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're always dealing with a corporate environment that tries to step above that simplicity level, but it's a battle. Of time.
Yes, it absolutely is a battle. And one of the things that came out of Code Red was people becoming much more aware of don't click on attachments. And that becomes a behavioral thing. And I think it also needs to be a behavioral thing of don't treat your corporate email like it's a personal email address.
That's right.
It's
not.
It's very much not.
You are representing the company when you use your company email.
Well, that and the...
Yeah, among many other things.
You can choose your personal email provider and decide whether or not you are okay with them and stuff like that. Once you're in the corporate environment, you have no control over the policies that that corporate environment may do, whether they can look at your email, which they do, or, you know, whether they are following good security habits.
Yep.
And so you really should limit it to company business.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. And, you know, when Miles was talking about separating your corporate versus your personal email, it's a very important thing to do. Our web browsers can do that for us. Almost everybody has multiple web browsers installed in their machine. So one way to do it, I've seen people do this, is that, you know, for their company, they have to use Internet Explorer, and so they use that. And for their personal, they use something else like Firefox or Chrome. That's one way to segregate. But do you know that actually built into Chrome is actually user accounts. You can have users. And what that means, or people is what they're called. You open the browser and you go into settings and then you turn on...
Profiles.
Profiles?
Yeah.
I think it's... I don't know. It's called people
now
in the
it's
command.
It's called people.
It's called people.
But it's also called users and it's also called persons.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. But the point is that this feature is hidden until you turn it on. So you have to go into settings and find this... persons, profiles, people,
add
thing.
Person, yeah.
Add a person. What this does is your logged in state sticks with the person. So I have a person called Netflix because I work at Netflix, and a person called Trucks, which is my last name, which is my personal. And I also have a GeekSpeak one. And so my browser is logged in and set up, and I toggle that when I want to switch contexts.
So it's almost like you have different copies of Chrome. That's
it's almost like
it
different copies running,
like,
exactly.
And they connect to each other, but they're very separate from each other.
Right. I mean, a perfect example is I do use Facebook personally, and I have a Facebook account, but also I test with Facebook because we at work, I integrate with Facebook. So I have to have a logged in fake Facebook account, right, to test with. And that would be confusing if I was linking my real account to my fake account, right? So separation is really important. But because of that, it's very easy for me with a glance to understand the context that I'm currently in.
There is also something to be said for using a private mode. If you're at
work, incognito,
using private browser mode or incognito or something like that, because all of the browsers have that feature.
Right.
And having your personal email and your personal affairs and your banking in there, it won't hide your activity from your employer because they can still see the network traffic, but they can hide the contents of it, and nothing gets saved to your work computer, which is the most important part.
Yes, good point. Meaning that if you have a work computer using this on, when you're dealing with the stuff, the stuff gets loaded to your machine, that is on physical property of the corporation, though copies of that is legal for the corporation to make. And when I say it's legal, you might think, well, they're not going to do that. Why would they care? It's not about that. It's that you set this all up automatically so that the company can... No one person controls this. It kind of happens.
So they have backups as well.
Yeah.
Because people's laptops will fail, so they need to be able to restore back from where it was before.
So an incognito kind of version is better because the caching doesn't actually get put to disk. It stays in memory. All right. So that's a lot of detail, and it's actually not as easy as that and simple. But there's a start.
Well, I don't know. Opening up in incognito mode to have all your personal affairs, that seems pretty straightforward.
Well, so the other thing I was thinking is that, you know, if you're on a personal computer and a personal network – the computer was given to you. We say, oh, if you SSL to a certain site, meaning secure TLS is the protocol, it's protected. But the truth is a corporate computer can actually have a certificate in it that's a corporate certificate, and they can actually unencode everything that's going out and re-encode it because your machine is actually owned and trusted by that network. So it's in the situation of Sony, that might have been going on too. And that produces a level of don't do personal stuff on your on your work computer, like at all.
That's probably a better rule anyway. Yes, but that one I think is unrealistic. When people are at work, they still need to check their bank accounts. They still need to do things that through the day you can't do it outside of work hours. And more and more of our lives are online. Like, you just can't have such a strict separation. There needs to be some wiggle room there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And one of the ways a wiggle room happens is you use incognito mode.
You know what? Use your phone. Have a personal phone. Use that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hate using my phone for banking unless I have the app, but I don't trust the apps. I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
But you do trust Git, right?
Well, yes. So Git is a version control system. I'm not going to go really into detail of what that is, but if you're a developer and you use version control, you should know that a critical Git security vulnerability was announced. There is a fix. Go update now.
Yeah.
Right now.
If you're on Linux and you have the default like ext4, you know, file system, something like that, it doesn't affect you just because it's a case-sensitive file system.
Isn't Windows a case-sensitive file system?
It is not.
So actually, it doesn't matter on OS X or Windows if you're using NTFS or FAT or HFS Plus. Doesn't matter. No. You are affected according to what I'm reading.
If it is case insensitive.
Okay. Maybe
if you set up the Mac to be case sensitive file system, you're not affected. If you don't understand what we said, you don't have a case.
You're not using Git. Don't worry about it.
Right. If you don't understand what you said, you're not using Git, but you also have a case insensitive file system, just so you know. If you don't know what we're talking about, that's the case. You have to know to do it.
That's the case. Good one.
What else?
I don't know. I think I I think all OS 10 is affected still. I have a case sensitive file system and I had to update, yes. But HFS Plus is case sensitive.
Two different modes.
No, there it can be or it cannot be. You have to specifically format it as case sensitive.
Yeah, and if you are, you're probably not using Adobe products, so don't do that. Smile said earlier before the show. But let's talk about this other flaw, because Git vulnerability, no one actually knows anything about because no one uses Git except
for us. Alienating our users. Let's just keep going.
Let's talk about something that's vulnerable that everybody uses.
Oh, boy. This is really exciting. I want to talk about SS7. SS7, you say?
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, right.
I never even knew SS6.
Well, SS6. Oh, so SS7 is Signaling System 7. That is the...
Oh, the cell phone thing.
Yeah, that is the way that different cell phone networks communicate with each other. That's basically the way that calls are routed, the way that texts are routed, the way all those services work. So let's say that you have AT&T, right? And AT&T is doing all of this amazing work, let's just say, on securing their network and hardening against security vulnerabilities and everything. So, like, let's say their security is rock solid. They still need to use SS7 to communicate with Sprint or with T-Mobile or with whoever, right? Okay. So this is something that we just can't really get around right now. It is global and it routes calls.
Okay. So it's like an intermediary protocol that exists in every cell phone system, and the companies kind of use that protocol. It's necessary for the system backbone to work. All right.
Now
we know what SS7 is.
SS7 was designed in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Which is always a bad thing to hear.
Well, we didn't care about security nearly
as
much then.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
We didn't understand that.
The problem set was different.
Okay, that's a more pedantic way of saying it and much more accurate. But
no, like, there's so many different vectors that have been made available just because you didn't a lot of those vectors weren't even possible back in the 80s. So why would you
the reason I'm saying that is that in the 80s, if you happen to connect with another computer, which was difficult, you pretty much trusted that person because they were just as, you know, there was only 12 of them. And so you weren't so concerned about security.
Right.
That's all. People are saying, hey, here's a bash file. Go ahead and run that. It'll do some cool stuff in your file. You're like, oh, okay. Now you wouldn't do that. But
only
anyway.
Because then you knew who the people were and now you don't.
Right. The problem set is different.
Yes,
I agree. I agree with Miles. I'm ready to move on. Often I've wondered, like, as I speed down the highway in the passenger seat, or if I'm using a phone on an airplane, which I'm not supposed to do, I still get network connectivity, which is kind of amazing, because really what's happening is I'm speeding by all of these different cell towers, and somehow my phone is negotiating with all of them in such a way that I can continue a conversation without gaps.
Amazing.
That is amazing. That is SS7. That's one of the features in SS7, which has all kinds of security issues in it.
Oh.
And actually, even more that were just announced at a conference in Hamburg in Germany. So, it's pretty bad. It's actually to the point. One of the researchers phrased it as, it's like you secure the front door of your house, but the back door is wide open, right? Securing the front door is securing your own network, the AT&T network, the T-Mobile network, but the connection between that is extremely vulnerable.
So what can you do with this vulnerability if you were to hack in using it?
Pretty much everything.
Total access?
Pretty much anything, yeah. Okay. I mean, you can intercept calls and texts. It's hypothesized that governments have been using this to spy on, Angela Merkel or something like
so,
that.
So, Ben, what do you do about it?
Nothing.
You can't.
Yay! Yeah. It's just that the infrastructure is broken and...
Okay, so there is one kind of solution.
Well,
if you use
using your phone.
No, if you use an encrypted protocol on the phone that doesn't use the cell phone text or voice system but use the data line, and at your phone level you encrypt the data, theoretically you could get a secure pipe.
Theoretically.
Well, no, I would say
now,
probable.
They could see the data was passing through, but they couldn't see what
that
data was.
It was, would be completely white noise.
But that's not something that anyone can just pick up their phone and do trivially, you know?
Like, no, you have to install an app to do this kind of thing.
Exactly. There are ways to do it. It would mean also that your ability to talk on the phone would significantly decrease because you'd have to use data rather than the voice.
I use Google Voice, for example, on my phone sometimes. I'm assuming that Google Voice is encrypted. So when I make a phone call...
Google Voice...
Oh, actually, right. No,
Google
that uses voice
goes, phone. Yeah, exactly.
You'd have to use something like some other protocol, some kind of
I mean, you'd have to use something like
Skype or something like that.
Any kind of voice over IP thing.
Yeah.
Or SIP or
and
Skype.
And you have to be an encrypted one. Hangouts would do this.
Yeah.
Audio chat Hangouts, that's a Google product. That would encrypt it. And text messaging through Hangouts would also do it. So there you go. See something like that. Or Facebook stuff probably would work too.
Yeah. It's just a bad state of things.
All right. Let's talk about good state of stuff, at least outside the U.S. What's going on, Miles? Get us up to speed with network protocol stuff.
Yes, please say something that'll cheer me up.
Well, I don't think it's going to.
100 megabit internet connectivity is available to 59% of the U.S.
And that's okay.
It's not cheap.
Right.
In general, but it's available in 59% of the
U.S. Because it's in the its major cities have it. I can't get it in my house.
That's actually not necessarily true. Right. But gigabit internet connections, on the other hand, are at just 3%.
These are for home access?
Yes.
Yeah. That's not very big.
Yeah, and at the other extreme, 2% of Americans can't even get 3 megabit.
Because they live remote enough.
Or just in an area that has some problem, yeah. And when I look at that, gigabit is just 3%. Well, let's see. That's Google Fiber in a couple of cities.
Yep. And a couple other cities that have.
I forget what, SonicNet, I believe, is the one.
There's a few others.
So a small handful of cities have it even as an option.
Yeah.
So what can you do with that? Well, one of the things you can do now is, for example, if you're on Comcast and you get a 100 megabit connection, which they offer, you can watch HBO Go and Showtime now. on Roku devices, that is. So as long as you have a subscription.
Why couldn't you not before?
Because Comcast was blocking them.
Whoa, what?
Yep. If you had a Chromecast, you could watch HBO Go on it, on the Chromecast network.
Uh-huh.
If you had a Amazon or forgot what they were called, TV Fire.
I don't know.
Fire TV. There we go. Or a Fire Stick. You could watch HBO Go. If you had a Roku device, Comcast would block you.
No.
And this is the same thing of like, if you have an Xbox 360, you could get access to HBO Go on a Comcast network.
Okay.
If you have a PS4, you couldn't.
Wait, what? Why? Comcast turned this off, so now they're just letting anybody do what they want.
Well, Comcast now allows a Roku device to get it, but you still block if you have a PS4.
How does Comcast know if you have a PS4? And how are they filtering this?
Because when you have a device, you have to activate it. So I just went through this process with my folks.
Okay.
They just got a new TV, and it came with a Roku stick bundled with it. That's what made it a smart TV.
Yes.
And I knew that this was going to be a case, and I was wondering, okay, do I need to buy an Amazon, Fire device, Fire mm-hmm. Stick, or do I need to get another Chromecast? And then this announcement
Wait,
came out.
What do you mean you have to activate it from your home? I mean, couldn't you activate somebody else's home and then use it in your home? I mean,
no. So then you start it up, and you say, I want to have HBO Go, and then it says, oh, well, you need to...
Oh, okay. HBO Go, of course, is you have to have an HBO account. And the HBO account, if you have it through Comcast, is controlled in that way.
Right.
And so Comcast would give you a code for Xbox, but not for Roku. That would work for Roku. Now they'll support Roku. So it's not really their network. It's their rule about allocating a token that allows this device to play. It's not a network filtering system. Right. I mean, I know this is pedantic from my perspective, but it matters in the idea of how networks work for me to understand this. Okay, so what they started doing recently is allowing a code that would work in a Roku for HBO Go.
Yes.
Cool.
And that was because Roku complained to the FCC, and then Comcast went, oh, all right, here you go. But it's still this very much, yes, someone has already paid for HBO, but we don't want you to access it we only want you to access it in the ways that we prescribe, even though technically whether you access it on a PlayStation 4 versus if you access it on a Roku versus if you access it on a Chromecast, they're all essentially equivalent. They're all apps that are written by HBO to run on these devices.
Yeah. All right, cool. I'm glad they've added Roku. Roku's a cool product. Ben, you want to talk to us about Skype since we mentioned a minute ago?
I want to talk about the universal translator from Star Trek. The idea that you can put something in your ear and then anyone can talk to you in any language and, you know, it just gets translated for you. Well, that's basically what Skype is going for right now. So they have a beta out. I believe it's invite only. So you can talk in Spanish to someone who speaks English and it'll translate it to English and the computer will read it out loud in English and show it on the screen and vice versa. So theoretically, it could break down the language barrier.
Cool.
If it, you know, gets to the point where it works really well with multiple languages and everything. But I love that this is actually happening in some way, right? Now, whether or not it feels good and works really well, I'm not sure. It's a alpha thing and a very small rollout. But yeah, we'll see.
Very cool. Hey, I'll just mention that I got this last couple days Google Inbox invite. I'm using that. That's a different version of looking at your Google Inbox where it filters and groups things. I think it's pretty cool. I do. I have a few invites. If you'd like an invite, email me and I'll invite you. Okay, Ben,
I'm emailing him right now.
And yeah, it's pretty cool. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Miles Elam. Hey, Miles, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, thank you so much for being here, Ben.
See ya.
I just want to say, if you want to learn more about what we talk about on Geek Speak, go to geekspeak.org. We're going to update it right now with all the stuff we talked about. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use and reuse any of our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. As I said, to find out more, go to geekspeak.org. Of course, you can also join us on Google Plus and on Facebook and on Twitter and all that. And by the way, the theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And thank you, Michael, for volunteering that. Ben, Miles, we'll see you next week.